everyone, we're going to kick it off. My name's Alexis. I am a member of the Perth branch of Socialist Alternative and also of the National Tertiary Education Union, and I'm a Labor historian. So I'll be facilitating today. The buildings are open the whole weekend. Have coffee, morning tea, lunch and dinner. So all your needs are met right here on this very campus. And so we'll have lunch straight after this session. And there's stuff from the food trucks near the Red Flag Bar, near the Grant Street Theatre. Kath Larkin is our speaker for this session on Breaking All the Rules, the Clarie-O'Shea Strike. Kath is a delegate with the Rail, Tram and Bus Union, the RTBU. She has been a member of Socialist Alternative for 11 years now and is currently the candidate for the Victorian Socialist in the seat of Cooper. This is the seat held by Jed Carney, the former ACTU head. So Kath is not interested in getting bumped into Parliament, but does want to go head-to-head against a Labor Party hack. And we need to get all the help we can get. So there's actually an opportunity for any of you in this room, either if you're from Victoria or if you're sticking around for a few days after the conference, to help with that effort. It's going to be... there's going to be letterboxing and door knocking you can do, and in particular there's a mass joint door knock of Cooper, that seat and wheels, on the weekend. So I'm just going to pass that around, grab one if that's something you might be interested in. Okay, without further ado, I'm going to pass over to Kath.
You might not like it yet. All right. On the 15th of May 1969, Tramways Union leader Clarie-O'Shea was locked up in Pentridge Prison by Industrial Court Judge John Kerr, the same man... Yeah, exactly. The same man who went on to be Governor-General and dismissed Prime Minister Gough Whitlam. In response, 1 million workers took part in mass illegal rolling general strikes that stretched across the entire country. From Melbourne Trams, the Brisbane Waterfront, Wollongong Steel, Pilbara Mines, and so much more. There's almost no section of industry that wasn't touched by this strike. And often, striking workers were participating in this action against the rulings of their own union officials and the Australian Council of Trade Unions. So as workers across the country stared down the powers that be, the man around whom the strike revolved was Clarie-O'Shea, sat in the hospital wing of Pentridge Prison, while sympathetic Cook kept him up to date on the latest news coming through the radio announcing which sections of workers had gone on strike. On just the first day after he was jailed, O'Shea received congratulatory telegrams from a combined union meeting in Port Kembla, the New South Wales Teachers Federation, 500 delegates from a meeting in Newcastle, a message from stop work meetings, including 400 construction workers at APM Botany, crane drivers at Cockatoo Dock, 600 meat workers in Brockwicks, New South Wales Power Workers and the Everleigh Locomotive Workshops. But one of the indications of how much O'Shea's actions really touched workers, I think, is that in addition to the kind of motions and letters from formal meetings, were the kind of little cards and personalised letters a bit like this, that were often addressed Clarie-O'Shea, temporary resident, Pentridge Prison. And many of the letters also came from workers who were in unions who didn't support the campaign against the penal powers, and they wrote not only to O'Shea, but to their union leaders and to the ACTU. So the strike wave went on to make the penal powers a dead letter, forcing the state to free Clarie-O'Shea and struck fear into the heart of the establishment. So probably to most people in this room, it seems obvious why we would want to celebrate this wonderful example of workers' power. But this isn't just a cool story. Today we're faced with pretty similar challenges. Striking is virtually illegal in pretty much every circumstance, except for a very tiny window under very kind of specific conditions during an enterprise bargaining period, which only comes around every 3 to 4 years, and even then they can manipulate the laws to cancel or try to prevent those strikes, as was the case with the New South Wales rail strike. Unions are now fined at rates never before seen and are threatened sometimes with the total wipeout of some of our institutions through bankruptcy. So we're once again forced to deal with the question of how to confront these rotten rules. As socialists and workplace militants, we can't just stand on the sidelines and snipe. We have a responsibility to learn the lessons of the strike, to learn what needs to be done in the here and now, and to throw ourselves into that project. So in my talk this morning, I want to make some of the arguments about what I think made this strike possible. One was rank and file organisation, networks of militants organised largely around the Communist Party who could defy more conservative class collaborationist union officials, a conscious decision by a left-wing section of the union movement, and a period of broader social radicalisation, most notably around resistance to the Vietnam War. I guess it's worth starting with a brief explanation of what the penal powers were. The penal powers were a series of laws that existed under the Federal Conciliation and Arbitration Act, first passed in 1904 and amended several times. The two important and most widely used sections at the federal level were Section 109 and 111. If a union or its members went on strike, Section 109 could be used, the employer could seek to use Section 109, if they could use 109 to declare the strike illegal, to have it banned, and if they breached this order, then they could be charged with contempt under Section 111. So the prohibitions against striking were not just in the Act, they're often actually inserted into the very awards of the industries themselves. And it's important to know that this campaign didn't just appear out of thin air. It wasn't just one pig-headed union official telling the boss's court to get fucked. The Communist Party, as you should, the Communist Party had been making arguments for years about the need to defy the penal powers, that is, not only to take the strike action, but to refuse to pay the fines. A number of key strikes involving the Communist Party led in 1963-64 laid a real basis for the possibility of defying the penal powers. Heavy penalties were threatened and imposed, and some unions did have some successes in repealing the penal powers within their specific awards. And you get a flavour for this kind of sentiment through the speaker's notes of a Communist Party federal election campaign in 1964. A big movement has arisen to force repeal of anti-strike laws. Strong action by Wharfies won repeal of Section 52A. Transport Workers' Union, by threat of nationwide stoppages, got bans and limitation clauses removed from the award. The West Australian Arbitration Bill, increasing penal powers, was met by a one-day general strike in November 63. And last May, the ACTU conference nearly carried a motion the nationwide protest against penal laws, defeated only 84 votes to 63. We must demand the repeal of these laws and demand that if the Labor Party wins majority in the Senate, it shall use its majority force to repeal in the near future. And this campaign did, over time, shift the Labor Party to supporting the demand as well. Despite all of the kind of positive kind of indications from militants and the communists, the Communist Party still held on to the belief that they required support from the ACTU, that they needed official endorsement to be able to carry out this campaign. So, unfortunately, in many ways, the opportunities presented by 63 and 64 went unanswered. However, opportunity did come knocking again in 1968-69 with the absorption battles. So unionised workers in many industries, particularly the metals, had successfully won over award pay and conditions, much to the frustration of the bosses. And they'd sought for a long time to get more support from the Arbitration Commission. And in 1967, the Commission while granting a pay rise, also recommended that this pay rise could be absorbed into the already existing pay rises. So it meant, in effect, no pay rise at all. This led to an explosion of industrial militancy. Hundreds of strikes occurred across the country in late January and early February, and a national 24-hour stoppage involving nearly 200,000 metal workers across the country in February. 2 days later, the ACTU Disputes Committee recommended that a national strike of all unions be called unless the dispute was settled within the week. Already some employers had been folding, but at this point they all gave in and the pay rises were granted. So obviously an important victory, but in the process of this, huge numbers of fines were handed out. 405 fines were issued against the metal unions, which amounted to about $98,000 plus legal costs of $87,000. But the employers were overplaying their hand at this point, and this began to tip workers over the edge. It led directly to several important unions declaring that they would refuse to pay any more fines. In May 1968, the AU Commonwealth Conference declared, "In light of our members' clearly expressed determination to fight the penal powers, this conference determines that no further or outstanding fines will be paid by the AU, and any move to forcibly collect any fines will be met with industrial action by our members." The Federal Council of the Boilermakers and Blacksmiths Society resolved in April 1969 to support any union that refused to pay fines and warned the ACTU that if it failed to accept the importance of such a campaign of resistance against the penal clause, the Federal Council would be directed to campaign with other militant unions. And in March 1969, the umbrella organisation of white collar unions also advised its members not to pay any fines in response to the Association of Draftsmen, Engineers and Surveyors being fined. So in January 1969, the Communist Party's National Committee voted to carry out a bolder confrontation of the penal powers and the arbitration court. The stage was being set for a major showdown. The militancy of trade unions and workers was not simply a kind of knee-jerk syndicalist reaction. This was about a section of the union movement led by Communist Party and also some in the socialist left unions making a clear political break with the right of Melbourne Trades Hall in 1967, who were attempting to organise the union around getting the ALP elected to both Houses of Parliament. I've heard that one before. In response, 27 left-wing unions split from Melbourne Trades Hall. They were known as the Rebel Unions. It was these rebel unions who organised the campaign against the penal powers, the delegates' meetings, the protests and the strikes. In this period, the organisation of shop committees increased, which was formed by militant and typically communist workers to allow them to organise their workplaces across sectional union divides and without the deadening influence of union bureaucracies. In 1968, rank-and-file boilermakers in WA took on the penal powers head-on and won. They had gone on strike in protest of a unionist in their workplace being replaced. Union intervention successfully saved their jobs, but the men were fined $30 each, which was a lot more money at the time, for going on strike and for refusing to return to work, and were threatened with 30 days jail. Shortly after this order was given, their employer actually went under, but nonetheless, the WA Employers Federation continued to press to get back these fines. The workers weren't just refusing to pay up, because they didn't want to. They made a conscious decision that they were not going to pay these fines in order to fight the penal powers. The AU wrote in their monthly journal, "They consider that in view of the vicious nature of the penal clause of the Act, they would make a stand and go to jail if necessary to assist in the campaign to highlight the situation and have the Act amended." You almost get a sense that a whole bunch of people are waiting for their chance to be the one that goes to jail for this. A meeting of union executives, shop stewards and delegates on the 7th of November voted to organise a statewide strike of all non-essential industries in the event that the men were sent to jail. Over the next couple of days, from Wyndham in the north to Albany in the south, advice was flowing for a great general strike. Officers of the council and officials of the union have never experienced the amount of unity and determination that developed during this period, but they didn't get their chance. The Trades and Labour Council was advised that an anonymous benefactor had paid the fines and the matter was resolved. The increase in the development of political consciousness among rank-and-file workers was, of course, taking place against a backdrop of a broad radicalisation, both around political and economic questions here and internationally, notably with students and young workers typically playing a leading role. In January in 1968, the Tet Offensive in Vietnam was really a kind of turning point and the catalyst for mass resistance on the streets all around the world, as the slogan, "Stop work to stop the war," is adopted by the Vietnam moratoriums. The fight for abortion rights gains its momentum in this period and in fact reaches its peak alongside in 1969, alongside the strike. They too knew the importance of breaking the law to change it. Internationally, the civil rights movement exploded across the US. Polish students and workers shut down the tertiary sector. French students and workers brought down their government. The hot autumn of Italy saw struggle of revolutionary proportions, and there was no doubt that the workers' movement was imbued not just with the radicalism of the Australian student anti-war movement, but the global revolutionary spirit of the time, which is evident from the union newsletters and newspapers of the time. As a public transport worker and as a militant in the RTBU, the union to which the tramways merged, and also as the granddaughter and grandniece of immigrant rail and tram workers, you know, including my grandfather, Andy Gallagher, who worked at the Preston Depot and was a participant in the O'Shea strike. But really, the more I read about this strike, the thing that makes me and the people in this room inheritors of the legacy of this strike, it's not our connection to the transport industry, but our commitment to radical politics. Because this was not specifically a transport strike. This was a revolutionary or a radical strike. In many ways, it's a bit of an odd quirk of history that the strike ends up revolving around O'Shea and the tramways. This union was not the most industrially significant at the time, not that we like to admit it, nor the union that received the highest numbers of fines at the time. And oddly enough, the Tramways Union were actually defending a decision of the Commission. So in 1965, the Tramways Board attempted to abolish the conductors, despite a decision by the Commission that the Board had to seek negotiations with the union before doing so. And in the process of this fight, the Tramways Union was fined $10,800, including legal costs. Suddenly, the court register demanded the immediate payment of... the union agreed to pay them, but at a rate of $100 a month. And was doing so for 18 months before suddenly the court registrar demanded immediate payment of $3,000. The union said it could not pay that amount, but suggested increasing monthly payments to $200, which was refused. Then in 1967, a new provision in the Act gave the registrar the right to obtain an order from the industrial court to compel a union official to appear before examination. Not dissimilar, I think, from what faces the construction workers in the ABCC, pretty much a carbon copy of the racist anti-terror laws. Certainly, this is an example of the way in which the legal system is so easily manipulated to deny workers' rights. Like, just to recap on this particular dispute, the union is defending a decision of the commission. They get fined anyway because they take industrial action. The award is changed that actually makes their actions legal, and still they're pursued. The board itself was in breach of the commission, but because it appears to the High Court, the union is expected to fit the bills for that. And there's actually no legal avenue for the commission to force the officials to show their books, so they just make a new law. And the quibble isn't even over a refusal to pay the fines. It's over the rate at which they're paying these fines. So in October, a bailiff was sent to take inventory at the union offices, and orders were submitted to the Commonwealth Bank, where union funds were held. 3,741 was withdrawn, which still left thousands of dollars owing on the fines. A month later, the Tramways Union cops another 2,400 as its members refused to work with a scab at Glen Huntly, which brings the total back up to 8,100 plus a whole bunch more in legal fees. So the registrar obtains a summons for O'Shea to appear in court and the union's with the union's financial records and sets a date for the 20th of March. On the 6th of March, the Australian Council of Tramways Union meet in Hobart and pass the following motion, written collaboratively with Communist and Leader of the Metal Unions, Laurie Carmichael. Council gives notice. In the event that the court seeks to collect such fines and costs from other branches or proceeds against the person of the Victorian Branch Secretary, we will take national action, and that this action is to be mandatory across all branches. Sorry. O'Shea initially dodges the court, which prevents the summons from being served. The rebel unions need a little bit more time to organise, I suppose. But eventually they do agree that they're going to have Clary O'Shea turn up to court on the 15th of May. So the unions call a shop stewards and delegates meeting for 8 a.m. at Festival Hall. 5,000 attended and voted, with one against. Who was that loser? I can't imagine they got out of that meeting well. For a resolution that declared, "We determine that any attempt to take direct punitive action against any union funds or property of the person of any official will be met with immediate 24-hour stoppage of work." Following the vote, thousands marched to the industrial court on the corner of Little Bourke Street, chanting, "All the way with Clary O'Shea," a clear mocking reference to the imperialist slogan of the time, "All the way with LBJ," in support of the US war in Vietnam. This great meeting and march was all supposed to occur in a way that got Clary O'Shea right to the doors of the commission exactly on time. If anyone's been to any union event, that literally never happens. Didn't quite go according to plan. At some point during the march, Clary realises he's going to be massively late, so he runs back to the back of the march, finds a film crew, they race him up to the court, and he gets there just in time as that odious toad Kerr is pronouncing him another no-show. He's then promptly directed to the witness box, and O'Shea shows the boss's court exactly the respect it deserves, saying, "I do not, sir. I do not wish to be sworn. I challenge the authority of this court to deal with my case. I'm merely defending the funds of my organisation." Kerr attempts, "I do not want to hear any speeches from you," which is always going to be futile. O'Shea continues, "I'm a paid servant of my members. I'm directed to protect their interests at all times, whether it is in regard to their wages, working conditions or their funds, and I am doing what appears to me and to our members to be the only logical course that I can take to protect their funds." Thousands of unionists and students wait outside, awaiting the outcome, listening to speeches and tussling with the police. So in closing the hearing, Kerr took a swipe, declaring, "People who choose, by what is fashionably nowadays called civil disobedience, to defy the law, do so on their own responsibility and must take the consequences. In those circumstances, Clarence Lyle O'Shea, I have no alternative but to order you to be committed to prison and there to be detained until you shall make the satisfaction of the court proper, answer on your oral examination, or until the court should otherwise order." The news was met outside with a wave of righteous anger. The Age reporter, Laurie Carmichael, finished his speech with, "It's discipline today, and discipline means no pubs, but back to work to get the workers out." The rebel union swung immediately into the sort of action that they'd been preparing for all of this time. Ken Carr, Secretary of the Rebel Unions Committee and State Secretary of the Federated Furnishing Trade Society, described the scenes at their quarters. By the time the officials had assembled, it was after 3 p.m. The atmosphere in the Builders Labourers Building across the road from Trade Hall was almost indescribable. When the chairman, Jack Healey, opened the meeting, reports came in thick and fast. George Windenberg of the Engine Drivers and Firemen announced that his executive would meet at 5, but he was confident they would support the strike. After talks with his members in the Latrobe Valley, he was suggesting a power stoppage from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. Jack Brown of the ARU stated that his executive had adjourned and its meeting to await our decision. John McEwen, the Builders Labourers organiser, who was on the phone, continually had to interrupt the meeting. Provincial Trades and Labour Council had rung. Would officials be available to speak at a meeting in their centres? Jim Ralston of the Boilermakers was wanted on the phone and came back with the news that more than a dozen unions were stopping in New South Wales. By just after 5 p.m, Bill Burke was able to announce that a telegraphic vote was being taken from his executive. He was confident the transport workers would stop. This flurry of organising and excitement contrasts quite sharply to the cowardly class collaborationist tone of the ACTU executive. The minutes of the executive record that the president refused to even have a discussion about the jailing of O'Shea. He argued that the appropriate resolution had not been made available to them. The hundreds of thousands of workers across the country didn't need a resolution to know which side they were on or what needed to be done. Friday the 16th of May, the first day of the strike, saw a mass meeting at Olympic Park in the rain, followed by a march of thousands to the industrial court, afterwards where fights broke out between unionists and police. On the same day, 1,200 also met in Geelong. The Australian Tramways and Motor Ombus Employees Association, that's why I just call it the Tramways Union, held a four-hour stoppage in virtually every state. While a union official sat in jail for defending his members, and according to the Tribune, 500,000 workers across the country were taking part in industrial action, the Victorian Trades Hall Council attempted to pass a motion from Melbourne Trades Hall which read, "Affiliates are in no way obligated to participate in unauthorised stoppages and actions contrary to the rules, procedure and decisions of the ACTU." They were stopped only by members of the rebel unions who disrupted the meeting of the Trades Hall officials and called them out for their slimy action and made the meeting totally unmanageable so the motion couldn't be passed. A tradition some in this room have carried on at times. The ACTU met with the Tramways Union officials in a failed attempt to force the Tramways Union leader to place leadership into the hands of the ACTU. Sunday, the 18th of May, the rebel unions had spent much of the weekend organising resistance around the country. The ACTU, on the other hand, desperate to broker some compromise with the bosses and the government, met with the government ministers. Did I miss that slide? Yeah, I think I did. So they tried to meet with the government ministers and came to the Tramways Union with what they thought was a lovely compromise, that if O'Shea agreed to pay his personal fines within 14 days and the union agreed to pay $300 a month, O'Shea would be released and the books would not be looked at. Not so much a compromise as a total sellout. Again, the Tramways Union thankfully refused. Monday. Contrary to the desires of the ACTU, the strike continued to build. In Queensland, the TLC backed O'Shea and a general strike in Queensland brought out 150,000 workers. Laughably, the Vice President of the Storeman and Packers Union in Queensland was annoyed that the Queensland members had gone on strike despite the union hierarchy urging them not to. In the Northern Territory, a number of key unions struck, staging a march of around 1,000 unionists through Darwin, while miners across the state struck. Tuesday, the 20th of May, a mere 5 days after the jailing of O'Shea, The Age, hardly the Tribune of the People, rather the opposite, writes an editorial calling on the government to scrap the penal powers in fear of the total industrial disintegration brought on by the general strike. On the same day, a second major strike occurs, even broader than the first, involving 40 unions with 500,000 in Victoria, importantly including many of the non-rebel unions. So the BIWU secretary, Joe Chandler, declared, "Our union is not one of the group now suspended from the Trades Hall Council, but on April 21st, 1969, we carried a resolution suggesting that our members hold job meetings in support of the Tramway Employees Union when Clary O'Shea was jailed, and we again looked at the situation and decided to direct our members to stop work and attend stop work meetings held on May 20th. I am pleased to say that the response from our members has been overwhelming." All public transport ceases. Trams, trains and buses aren't running. Industrial action by power workers restricts electricity output to allowing for only two lights and no radiators between 7 a.m. and 7 p.m. Stoves were only to be used if no alternative method of cooking was available, and gas was completely banned. Television was restricted to 1:30 to 2:30 p.m. And 3:30 to 5:30. Oh, they weren't fucking around. Absenteeism of city workers, not officially on strike, reached up to 15% on that day, with The Age reporting that this was due not only to the difficulty getting to work, but because of massive sympathies with the strike. The South Australia Trades and Labour Council called a general strike involving 100,000 workers. A general strike in Tasmania saw unions covering 80% of the workforce going out. In Canberra, 14,000 unionists struck, including the Governor-General chauffeur, which forced the Governor-General to cancel meetings because he couldn't drive himself. There was a meeting of 3,000 in Darwin. In New South Wales, 6,000 waterside workers struck, and 20 unions called for a 24-hour strike on Thursday. That evening, the Attorney-General announced that he'd given instruction for the order to release Clary O'Shea. That afternoon, a former advertising executive of the Australian Financial Review, Dudley McDougall, had walked into the registrar's office and paid both the union's fines and O'Shea's personal fines after apparently a lottery win. McDougall said, "I could sense a confrontation between the might and the right, and that is disastrous to the whole community. My pygmy effort is just a gesture to avert that direct confrontation, which can only mean hardship for the man and woman in the street and the country itself." Now, whether you believe this story or not, and O'Shea certainly didn't, he still thinks ASIO had something to do with it, it was clear that the order to release O'Shea was a victory forced by a militant union uprising. Wednesday, the 21st of May. But that's not the end of it. The next day, a major transport strike in New South Wales cancelled trains across the state, buses in Newcastle, Wollongong and Sydney, and ferries in Newcastle and Sydney. Waterside workers were also on strike. At 11 a.m, O'Shea is released from Pentridge, defiant as ever, addressing crowds of workers. "My release is a great victory for the workers, working people and all other Democrats who have stood up against the shackling of workers' struggle. My imprisonment and release were only a small part of the much bigger question of the oppression of the workers. I will try to play my full part in bringing it to an end. Neither the Tramways Union nor I have paid a single cent of the fines, nor will we ever do so. Australian workers have never before conducted such a magnificent struggle, and I feel certain that we will use the initiative they have displayed so far in this struggle to some much more radical social advances, such as social services and pensions." Thursday, the 22nd of May. The strike is still continuing, a day after O'Shea's release. Because, you know, many of the strikes had been planned before he was released, and why not? Besides which, the rotten laws were still on the books, so there was still something to fight for. The New South Wales strike went ahead with around 100,000 workers in Sydney, tens of thousands in Wollongong and Newcastle, the second ever general strike in Western Australia, and members of 85 unions and an estimated 100,000 workers participated, the Musicians Union were involved. So the West Australian Symphony Orchestra shut down for the day, cancelled concerts, and musicians playing in hotels and on the TV did the same thing. And after a week of national general strike, the ACTU finally, after O'Shea's been freed, finally gets in behind the campaign and calls for unions to cease paying the fines. They were under enormous pressure from rank-and-file unionists. Vice President Jack Petrie argued in the debate in favour of supporting the stance because there must be a clear positive decision put to the rank and file which will restore authority in union leadership. If that's what gets you there, mate. The laws were not immediately totally struck off following the general strike, but the government dare not use them again for fear of inciting such another response. Only three unions were fined under the penal provisions following the general strike, but none of these fines were ever paid. In 1970, the Arbitration Act was amended to remove the most punitive elements of the penal provisions. When large-scale fines did re-enter the industrial situation, it was through different mechanisms. This is a mighty example of breaking the rules in order to change them. Every single element of this strike was illegal. So why is it possible? How can you have illegal strikes? Well, frankly, it's because workers run the world. Literally. We don't have democratic control over it, but we actually run everything that makes society function. We run the transport networks, or sometimes shut them down. We run, you know, we educate the children in schools, tend to the sick in hospitals. Workers who are making the lights stay on right now, all of this is done by our labour, so we don't need them. They actually don't play a useful role in this society. Simply by folding our hands and refusing to act, we start to grind their system to a halt, and that's what gives us power. Obviously, that doesn't mean we don't fight to change shit laws. Myself and a lot of the people in this room have been part of various struggles to do just that. Whether it was the free speech campaign under Joe Bjorke-Peterson in Queensland, ripping up the homophobic marriage ban recently, or indeed the campaign to change the rules today. But this, in this instance, it was an illegal strike that won the right to strike. While many of today's union officials portray strikes as a sort of a necessary evil that workers are forced into by unfair bosses, socialists view strikes as the glimmer of what's possible, that point to a much grander vision of a socialist society brought about by an international workers' revolution. I haven't lived through a general strike in this country, but I have had the opportunity to see and experience much smaller examples of this power. When workers defy the bosses, we gain back a little bit of our humanity. We make our own decisions. Our energies are expended fighting for ourselves and for the people we care about, for a better world, rather than being another cog in the machine of exploitation. I'm reminded of a young Maori woman, Tanga Nui, on the Polar Fresh picket line 3 years ago, who was leading arguments about keeping up the secondary picketing, which is, of course, illegal, pushing to increase the militancy of the picket line, taking on mouthy scabs and managers. She was the last person to step off the picket line of one of the secondary pickets when the union called them off. And certainly, when we went on strike, the RTBU, in 2015, it was hands down the best day of my life. The kind of pride and excitement that we felt walking off the job, marching up to Trades Hall, then marching back to Flinders Street with hundreds of others from our unions, met by even more from across the union movement. Really, like, it gave you a sense of your power. It was a total opposite of the kind of regular degradation that you experience, and we certainly experience as customer service workers in the railways. So there is nothing automatic about struggles going forward, but we know that when a lead is given, as it was in the case of the 60s and 70s, the working class confidence that's developed by struggle and the lessons learnt in the process of struggle can further spur on further action. Hopefully, yeah, you can read that. So the victory of the 1969 general strike opened up the floodgates. By 1971, 30% of workers were involved in strike actions. Strikes peaked in 1974 as did the rate of unionisation 2 years later at 56% in the midst of this strike wave. The share of wages as a proportion of GDP rose to its highest ever levels. Conditions like 4 weeks annual leave, workers' compensation and the principle of equal pay were won in this period. Many of these conditions are still enjoyed by workers today, but we do know that reforming capitalism is like the labour of Sisyphus. We collectively roll that mammoth boulder up to the top of the hill, but the bosses don't just give up. The class war continues as they try to push the boulder back on us. You can see that through the increase of casual and insecure work. You can see kind of the winding back of some of what we have won in significant pockets of industry. And the class war will be ongoing until we push that boulder all the way over the hill and found a totally new society out of the ashes of the old. So as socialists, we know our kind of ultimate goal of revolution. And much of this conference will be spent with our kind of heads up, looking at these examples like we're seeing sweep Sudan and Algeria at the moment. But we also know that there is an importance of being able to kind of put your head down and kind of look all the way back to where your feet are now to try to understand the next step forward. And so we want to try and take some of the lessons to do just that. So the Clarioche strike has plenty of them. I think it demonstrates, first of all, the importance of a commitment to rank and file organising. The Communist Party mantra is one we should all try to live by, make every member an activist. Whether that means organising your first strike or signing up the first person in your workplace to the union. 2, radical politics. The political leadership of the Communist Party at the time, a mass workers' party, flawed though it was absolutely crucial to the radicalism of the 60s and 70s, and it's precisely why Socialist Alternative is so committed to doing everything we can now to build up a socialist movement in this country. 3, a preparedness to go beyond the bounds of the oppressive anti-worker capitalist laws. We cannot have a victory if we insist on being shackled by these unfair laws. History moves in waves, not just along flat lines. We have no way of telling when the next strike break, when the next wave will be, when the hard slog of building union strength wherever we are at suddenly shifts, like the recent struggles of teachers across America, into a wave of strikes. We don't know when a wave of struggles intertwined with political radicalism and will fundamentally remake the terrain of the working class struggle like it did in the 60s and 70s. But history tells us that every advance we make for radical politics and radical forces here and now, as well as building up our union forces, is going to be what makes a difference and puts us in the best position to change our society.